Today is Thursday, April 6th, the year 2000. We're in East Lansing, Michigan at the Kellogg Center. I'm Jeff Charnley interviewing Dr. Gordon Geyer for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution, which we'll be commemorating in 2005. As you can see, Dr. Geyer, we're tape recording this oral history today. Do you give us permission to tape?
You bet. In fact, I think it's a great project. We need to make sure we capture all these important developments.
Thanks. I'd like to start first with your personal educational background. Where were you born, and how was it that you ultimately came to MSU? Start first with, where were you born?
Well, Jeff, I was a Michigander, and I was born down, born in Kalamazoo, but lived in Augusta, and started to get involved when I was in high school at the Kellogg Biological Station there at the forest. I worked there summers and got in biology and various things, and then after was in the service and came out in 47 and immediately utilized that Bill of Rights, which John Hanna and everybody else did, so came up here in 47 and from there on it was a fascinating development. I finished up my BS in 50 and I was already teaching a couple of courses in entomology. Started out with, I thought I was going to go into fisheries and wildlife, and I changed my major to entomology, which was, either one I guess would have been fine for me, but anyhow, I really hit entomology in the golden years, like everything else, the university wasn't growing very fast then, and there were no young professors in entomology, and so I started teaching a bit, and then by the time I got my PhD in 53, I had some nice job offers, which would look awful good today, but I was having such a good time, my research was going so well that I stayed on, and then I was department chairman in 63, which was a pretty young age, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then in 74, I took over the Extension Service as Associate Dean of Ag and did that until 84. And then I figured that was retirement and I'd made my commitment. And it's interesting, not one of those jobs did I ever apply for. None of them, Jeff. And then the interesting development was that Governor Blanchard was in power then as a Democrat, of course, and he invited me to take over the Department of Natural Resources. There were some rough challenges then, and so I ran the department. I said I'd do it for 2 years, and mm-hmm. he tried to bend my arm for a little longer, but I really enjoyed that. I knew everybody. I had, I think, over 35 of my students as employees, mm-hmm. and then I thought that was the end, and then Jack Breslin started to become ill, and Jack and I was quite dear friends, and so I helped him out, and then I got more involved as he got more laid back, and so when he passed away, they talked me into, DiBiagio was here, and he talked me into taking over that vice presidency, and I knew everybody from the legislature, and so it was a fun job for me, mm-hmm. and it was a great time, actually, and so I finished that up. I forget the exact date, but after about 3 years, and then all at once, DiBiagio was having his challenges with some of the board and the athletics, and so he decided to leave, and so the board enticed me to come on there for that year of transition in between DiBiagio and Peter, and so that was kind of a fun job. Again, I knew everybody, and from being involved with the vice presidency, and so Mrs. Geyer and I moved over to the Cowles House, and had a great rapport with the board and the students, and so I said that's it, and Peter came on, which was a good appointment, and I really figured at my age that was time to quit. And then our Republican governor, John, he said, I want you to run the Department of Agriculture. And I loved agriculture, so I went down and ran that. And so now what's it been, two or three years now that I've had a little freedom. Mm-hmm. So it's been a unique and an unusual situation when you have every job you love, and not one of them did you apply for. And you know, Jeff, the interesting thing is that that everybody almost without consistently asks you, you work for a Republican and a Democratic governor in a key spot where you saw them every week at two or three times, and which ones you like the best. And I always say the same thing, you know, they were both Spartans, so it didn't make a bit of difference. There were some differences, but I won't go into that.
The transition was an easy one.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your undergraduate years, and you mentioned the issue of switching your major from fishery and wildlife. Why were you interested in fisheries and wildlife initially?
Yeah. Well, I was an outdoors person, and
you hunted and fished?
I hunted and fished, and that's really how I got involved with MSU down there at the Kellogg Forest. Mm-hmm. I just enjoyed that and thought I wanted to be a forester or a fishery and wildlife or something, as a lot of kids do. Mm-hmm. And then I got up here and I took a couple of entomology courses, and for some reason it just clicked with me. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was a fascinating time because the entomology department, as I said, was made up quite a bit of older faculty, and E.I. McDaniel, which was an institution here, and of course I always said that entomology had the best record of confirming women in academics, because we only had about seven faculty and we had Miss McDaniel, so we looked better than most of the universities. But I went over to and somebody said, boy, she's a tiger. And so I went in, and this is kind of interesting because this is more of the culture of the times. And I had to get by her to get my major changed. And she said, she never even looked up from her. I was sitting across her desk, and she said, and she was moving critters around on her desk like this, and live critters.
Live critters.
And then she said, what do you want? And I said, Professor, I'd like to change my major. She said, you know what these are? And God, I didn't even realize they were spiders instead of insects. And mm-hmm. And she said, those are black widow spiders. And they just hatched out, and she was putting them back in a bottle. So she asked me some questions, and actually she and I became very good friends. But, you know, there's a person that never really got her to do, because she was one of the world's renowned taxonomists at that time and worked on some groups of moths and so forth, you know, it was interesting how dedicated and committed all of those faculty were. But I was so young compared to the rest of them. I actually was writing my thesis for PhD and writing Walt Murawski's, who had been here for 30 years, but they'd put on this new stipulation that the faculty, if they wanted to get raises, had to have their PhD, which they never were told that never happened. Mm-hmm. Some of them went away and came back, like Burke Martin in entomology, but Walt was doing his own on a forestry project, and you know, it's pretty tough to come back when you're in your 50s or 60s and write a thesis for a PhD.
That's right.
So anyway, I was writing both of them, but that's kind of a culture time of the times, you know. Here were these folks that were hired in the early 30s, and even before, and the university all at once said, if you're going to advance or do anything, you got to have a PhD. Very interesting.
And I've asked those veterans, several people that we've interviewed have been World War II veterans. Could you tell us briefly about where you served and the duration again, how long you served?
Yeah. I served 2 years, and I was in the Air Force, and I went, I wanted to be a pilot, but the war was starting to wind down a little bit, and so I got in, and I was a radio operator on a B-17, and went to Europe just as it was over. And so I spent about a year right on the base of Mount Vesuvius in Italy.
Oh, really?
And I flew around the Mediterranean, and it was a good experience for a young fellow. But, you know, you were so young, you didn't realize what was happening. And so the war was over in the Pacific by the time that I got out, finished there, and so I I got out and got to school.
Mm-hmm. So you were part of that large group of... Yeah. What was the campus like then?
Oh, it was fascinating because that was one of the most rewarding and creative things about John Hanna. Mm-hmm. He was so far ahead in his thought patterns of most administrators. Now that I look back, I see how. But he grasped right a hold of these thousands of students that are coming out, and first, you know, he made a place for us. I spent a few nights there in Jenison, mm-hmm. but they soon had housing, and then he brought in all this married housing, and he just hauled that cheap stuff away from the various like Fort Custer and so forth. Mm-hmm. And first he brought the darn trailers, and I'll tell you a little about that.
You were married at the time?
Not yet.
Oh, mm-hmm.
But then he brought the barracks, and everybody thought, you know, what's this? And probably, you know, the wisest. And then he found room for all of us, mm-hmm. and you know, the place just exploded.
You were accustomed to living in barracks.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What, you know, wasn't much of a transition.
But you ask about if I was married then. No, mm-hmm. And then I was doing graduate work, and I spent one summer, and I was sent into college. I was the only young guy available, and so when they had a catastrophe, why, I went. And so one summer they had an outbreak of white grubs in the Upper Peninsula, mm-hmm. and it was really a tiger. And so I went up to Menominee County and spent the summer there. And, you know, a young guy just out of the service, that was quite a nice summer. I caught a lot of bugs, but also, you know, it was kind of interesting. There was always a bunch of college-age kids around. Mm-hmm. Then the next summer I went to Lake City to the experiment station. And that's where I met my wife, and so we got married in December. And the reason I say that is that that the most fascinating thing was that we got one of those trailers, mm-hmm. and it was only 18 feet long and colder right in December, and not much insulation, and it was a couple of wrestling athletes had been in there, and it was bad. I mean, I opened that door and I thought, oh God, no, we can't go in there. But we did.
Wasn't much of a welcome for your bride.
Well, there was no welcome. And then, you know, you had the restrooms and the washrooms were about 50 yards up a wooden walk. And then you did your wash and hung it all up there. Well, the first basketball game, she hung up her wash and about all the clothes we had. We came back from the ball game and all the women's clothes was gone. And they finally found them in a garage out at Okemos. But it shows you the culture that was. Mm-hmm. But, you know, John Hanna was so creative a thinker in regard to taking advantage of whatever was there. You know, I've said this week, as we win this championship, you know, you got to go back to the late 50s when John was pulling every string he knew to get us in the Big Ten. Mm-hmm. And everybody thought we went in for athletics. Well, of course, it was important. Mm-hmm. But I know John knew that academics would accelerate, and he quickly hired Gordon Sabine. And all during the 50s, we were recruiting merit scholars way ahead of Harvard or Michigan or anybody, and nobody could understand what was happening. Mm-hmm. But old Gordon Sabine and that group they were contacting every merit scholar before anybody else. Mm-hmm. And our visibility as we went in the Big Ten was becoming quite prominent. So, you know, he knew exactly what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we were having trouble getting in and Michigan was fighting us so hard, and we never could get the votes, and his friends down at Notre Dame twisted the arm of the folks at Northwestern. We got our final vote and went in. Mm-hmm. Well, he always seemed to, and that was through the civil rights commitment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. His commitment to civil rights, and he'd gotten to be close with the Notre Dame president, and that's how we got in the Big Ten.
Interesting.
Yeah.
you mentioned some of your research. In the early days,
yeah.
Your master's and dissertation.
Yeah.
What was that specific research?
They were all on aquatic entomology, and that's what I was teaching.
Uh-huh.
But my research, I was getting in, and there again, I was the most fortunate rascal because I lately now I've felt only regret that I haven't had the time to write up what I call the Renaissance and Golden Age and fall, really, of the whole pesticide area. Mm-hmm. But you see, as a result of the war, and most of this has just not been recorded, pieces of it, but you see, by even 49, the materials that had been developed by Germany and the U.S. as a part of the war effort, chemical war effort, mm-hmm. Started to emerge. Things like DDT had been used, of course, during the war in the Pacific to keep GIs healthy from biting insects and lice and so forth. And then all the phosphates were mostly developed by the Germans. And so you had this huge array of chemicals that we never had before the war. Mm-hmm. And so as I merged with my degrees, these were all moving right along, and I just happened to fall off the end of a log. We had a terrible outbreak of onion maggots in this state. Onions at that time were worth about $9 million annually, I developed, I found out very simply, it was no Nobel development, but that some of these chemicals work very good. So I worked out of, and they were spraying huge quantities of DDT and other things to try to kill the flies, and it was less than successful. Mm-hmm. But I found a way to dribble a granulated material with that, with these chemicals on right in the row when you plant it, and it just worked miracles. So everybody thought I was a pretty hot shot, but actually it was just luck. So then I got into the control business in a variety of ways. And of course, as questions started to rise and the negative aspects of these pesticides started to show up, resistance. I suspect, Jeff, that if we could recreate it, we probably had the first resistance in probably U.S., right here in Michigan, because the first DDT in the Midwest was used on the flies up at Mackinac Island. And it was miraculous. The only trouble was there was a male and a female somewhere that had a resistant gene. And
to DDT.
Yeah, to DDT, right. And by the time I got involved, the boss sent me up there, old Prof Hudson, who was chairman, and said, see what you can do. And I said that summer there about half the raisins in the fudge was flies, and people didn't know it.
Oh, no. But
they were really thick.
Oh, no.
There was very little sanitation. They had one big landfill, and all the manure and all the garbage and mm-hmm. everything, and juice was breached. It produced flies. So, you know, I switched over to some phosphate materials, and it did a pretty good job, mm-hmm. but sanitation had to follow. Mm-hmm. But then you know, it wasn't long until we started spraying. We got the Dutch elm disease problem. We put DDT all over. We put DDT on with airplanes for mosquito control all through the Midwest. And then, of course, you know the history from there on. It started to, one, resistance develop. And I suppose I saw on Mackinac Island some of the very first. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we didn't really realize what it was going to do. Mm-hmm. And then I'm sure I saw some of the first accumulation of in the food chain, mm-hmm. which, you know, later in the late 50s and early 60s, why we had the catastrophe of the robins dying, mm-hmm. Rachel Carson's book. Well, by that time I was department chair, and I capitalized on that because money was flowing like wine for this kind of research federally. And so I got the money to build the pesticide research center, and this put us out in front along with the University of California and Cornell and North Carolina. So it was a fascinating time. And that's never been put together in a single, somebody should write a book on mm-hmm. the rise and fall of chemicals as a result of the war and Michigan's aspect, the same as the Civil War history, only it would make a fantastic story.
You were chair at the time of the Robins study?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And who did that? Were you involved in it?
That was George Wallace. George was, and you'll have to, this is a fascinating story because And there was a lot of bitterness because Cy Boyer was director of Plant Industry Division, Department of Agriculture, and he was a national hero. And he wouldn't accept the fact that there was that the robins were dying from DDT. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was so important in many of their regulatory programs. And so there was this conflict, and George had, the technology was very crude. His analytical methods were still chemical. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any gas chromatographs. And so George, even until he died, he never received the appropriate recognition. So when I was president, that's a long time in between. Mm-hmm. But I felt bad that George hadn't been recognized. So I gave George an honorary degree at commencement and called his daughter came up from Texas, and we really gave George the visibility he deserved. Mm-hmm. But, you know, George was a laid-back guy, but there again, he was light years ahead of a lot of other people, and he fell in, and, you know, there wasn't a robin left on the campus there. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the agricultural use of DDT. It was the massive use we were putting to Dutch elm disease. Every tree in East Lansing and many other cities was sprayed with DDT. Yeah. And we used tons of it for mosquito control right on the water. And
I remember as a kid, this would be 1957, 58, we spent the summer at a camp fishing in Six Lakes, Michigan, and they mm-hmm. sprayed at the camp, they sprayed this fog, and we kids just thought it was the greatest thing to go out and play in it.
I bet you it was DDT.
I'm sure it was.
Well, you didn't have any head lice or any problems.
No.
But actually, I always said, Jeff, that the DDT was a tremendous asset to protection of humans during the war. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was ever any mortality or anything, any even sickness from DDT in humans. And it was really a shame that we probably overreacted in the demise of it, because there, you know, today the best material going is DDT for kids' head lice, and there's no problem with it, but you'd mm-hmm. never get it back now. Mm-hmm. It was just the misuse of it, and that was an understandable situation, because nobody ever seen biomagnification or resistance or genes changing, you know.
Mm-hmm. When that first when Rachel Carson's book came out,
yeah,
and you mentioned you either took advantage of that to get the Pesticide Research Center on campus. Do you remember what happened at the time on campus? Was there anything in reaction to her book, or that you were involved directly, or?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. It was starting to be the era of activism anyway. And her book developed two camps. Those, like I mentioned, of conservative folks like Cy Boyer and others who in their own heart just didn't believe that these things were happening on this magnitude. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned you interviewed John Cantland. And John was a creative and visionary fellow. And then there was quite a confrontation. Today there would be excellent discussions, and you'd work this out. At that time, the animosities were pretty heated. And, you know, it was another 5 or 8 years before we really had the data. And I remember some of our best scientists. And one you could well interview and get a great deal from, and that's Dr. Robert Ball, who is still in excellent health and lives in Florida. He was probably turned out more quality graduate students that have gone with great reputations around the world during that time. And I remember Bob saying, once we discovered what they thought was 14 parts per million of DDT in Lake Michigan, and the gulls were dying and the eagles were gone and all of that, and he said, you know, it'll be a century before we see any demise of that, because Lake Michigan turns over water-wise about once every century. And Lord, in 10 years, shows you how little we knew about the... first we discovered it wasn't 14 parts per million of DDT in chlorinated hydrocarbons, but about half of that, seven. And the other seven was PCBs, which were a part of the mechanical industrial pollution, and the DDT and those chemicals went out relatively rapidly. And today they're still visible, but very low quantity. And of course, gripes, we got way more gulls than we want. We've got the eagles back, and so this is part of that. But Bob Ball would be a great guy to.
Okay. Which department was he in?
He was Fisheries and Wildlife.
Oh, okay.
All right. Yeah, and if you decide to contact him, it'd be a if you got any interviewing in Florida, I'd highly recommend it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That should be recorded for the history of this place.
Yep. Absolutely. The going back to the Pesticides Research Center. Mm-hmm. Did you direct it as?
Yes,
is that part of your dual role?
Well, what happened was Sylvan Whitwer. You mentioned you're going to interview, and Sylvan was a great supporter. I went. I developed a nucleus. I think there was about a dozen of us at the height of researchers who all had an interest, and I it probably wouldn't have worked, but I didn't have any personal gain. Because I didn't have a lot of research in that area. I just coordinated as chairman. And so there wasn't any, and I allocated the money. And so I first got we started getting a grant. So there was federal grants available for centers of excellence. And North Carolina State and Texas A&M and the University of California and Cornell were the centers along with us. And so we got, in those days, which was a lot, 4 or 5 to 100,000 to a year for research. And then we didn't have the facilities appropriately. So Sylvan and I put together a request and went to Washington, and he put some money in from the experiment station, and we got enough money to build a center. And that kind of brought everybody together. And it was a unique situation because nobody got into a hassle about his faculty do about competing with each other, because I was allocating the resources and I didn't have any set agenda, see. Mm-hmm. And it was we were socially close, and we were academically together and technically together. And
so this was within the university, a cross-disciplinary
it was
approach.
It was one of the very successful first interdisciplinary teams that we had. Okay. And a lot of those fellows are still, there's a few of them that are still active today, Dr. Reese and several of them that were a part of that first team. They're retired, but they're still in their labs every day.
Mm-hmm. The 1960s, you were chair of mm-hmm. entomology at that time. What was the student climate like in the 60s?
Yeah, there was a lot of, and of course, the whole the chemical situation was, but that was a time when activism was prominent, and, you know, it was a whole different culture on the campus, and I don't think those folks that were presidents then had a very good time, but I.
There were challenges to
authority. Oh yeah, but there was still a lot of dedicated students who were committed, and a discipline like entomology, they were much more conservative than the student body in general.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised when Dr. Hanna left? When he resigned, or when
no,
he went to Washington?
And the more, you know, no, I wasn't. because, you know, 26 years. But is somebody just recently, you know, as smooth as things go, after 5 years or 6 years or so, I don't know, depends on the president, but in any institution, whether it's General Motors or Michigan State, you get into some kinds of hassles after, and you know, John had been super successful, and yet, if you read the history, John had some challenges with his boards then, too. Mm-hmm. And I always said, and I say today, and John, of course, I'm his greatest fan, and I think it's a fabulous family, but I said he only made one mistake in 26 years, And that mistake was when he was so powerful with the Constitutional Convention that we allowed to have all of the trustees elected. I think if we'd elected half of them, but I don't care whether Democrat or Republican, I think that for institutions that you'd get some alums that be appointed that would be you wouldn't have had the rough edges that we've had. And I think that was already starting to show up in John's regime. So I think, you know, first he'd had 26 very successful and tough years here. I wasn't surprised. And he was dedicated to civil rights. He got into that because he believed in it. And everything, he was just the best at what he went to Washington for. So, no, I wasn't surprised.